What will happen next after CAL FIRE's declaration yesterday that PG&E's power lines had started the campfire? On Insight, we'll explore the legislative answer to that question in this week's Capitol Chat. Our Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler is standing by. Mary Mackey has won an important prize for her poetry collection titled The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. You might remember Mary's visit when the book launched in September. She's now just back from New York, and we'll talk about the impact of the prize and the man it's named for. Then Sound Advice features Gary Vercelli's interview with Australian-born jazz singer Sarah McKenzie. She has a new album out. It's called Secrets of My Heart. She plays the San Francisco Jazz Center next month, and her music might be something to add to your weekend listening. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. Live from Capitol Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. CAL FIRE says it was purely coincidental that yesterday, while the new CEO for Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, was testifying in Sacramento, CAL FIRE announced that sparks from PG&E's power lines had started the fire that became the campfire blaze last November. So the full report has been forwarded to the Butte County DA. The campfire, as many of you know, destroyed the towns of Paradise and Concow. Magalia was heavily damaged. Polga had burn damage, too. 85 people died. More than 19,000 structures, most of them homes, were fully or partially burned. The CAL FIRE report is where we begin this week's Capitol Chat, and our Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler is standing by at the Capitol. Hi, Ben.
Purely coincidental that I'm here, Beth.
Yeah, they said that they just released the information to the public as soon as they have it, and that happened to be the timing. There are more details about this from CAL FIRE that I'd like to cover with you. One of them is the fact that the Butte County DA's office is now going to consider criminal charges, Ben, and that plays heavily into this big picture.
Sure. And PG&E has been found criminally negligent in the past, in past events, thinking about the gas explosion, the pipeline explosion in San Bruno some years ago. And this, of course, comes at a pivotal moment for PG&E. I mean, you've got so many different issues that it's facing, the bankruptcy court, the liability laws. A lot of questions also for fire victims who, you know, despite this news, I'm told that this report is not necessarily admissible. This investigation, these findings are not necessarily admissible in civil lawsuits for, say, the town of Paradise or for individual fire victims. They have to use evidence to prove themselves. They may bring in CAL FIRE to testify what it found, but it's not like you can take this report and immediately put it into the record and everyone stipulates that it's going to be considered. At least that's what I was told yesterday as I was doing some reporting on this. And so this doesn't solve everything for them. We don't know if all the money's still going to be available that they want because PG&E's got a lot of creditors in bankruptcy court. And we also don't know if this means that ratepayers will still need to foot the bill for the campfire or if PG&E shareholders will.
So CAL FIRE tells me it's up to the DA's office to release the full report, which means there's not a guarantee that the public will ultimately see the entire investigation, Ben.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not something I know. One would think that if one side's going to use it in court, that the other side would get to see all of it. It's not like it's not like the Mueller report here, perhaps at some point in the discovery process or in the legal proceedings, the whole report would become public. But that's getting far ahead of ourselves at this point.
There is an interesting detail to note that there was that ignition site initially where the sparks were lit under a power line. Then the investigation says there was a second nearby ignition site too. And so that first fire kind of engulfed the second fire. And these are small sparks that lit vegetation on fire. But I think because of the tragedy that it became, we're all glued to the exact specific details of how this unfolded because it grips so many people in so many ways in this area.
Yeah, and I guess there had been some disagreement, and may still be, over that second ignition point involving distribution lines. You had the transmission tower that was the first one that had been pretty widely reported on, and PG&E even kind of acknowledged it in filings, you know, previously, that they believed they were responsible, and the CEO said yesterday to the legislature, I'd been assuming that we were responsible for that. The second ignition point... Well, maybe, maybe not. PG&E said in its formal statement it is not yet ready to conclude, not yet ready to accept the findings that CAL FIRE had on the second ignition point. But it said it does accept the findings on the first ignition point.
So PG&E had filed for bankruptcy protection in January. In February is when it became probable that one of its transmission lines had sparked the blaze. And all of that is more background to why PG&E's new CEO, Bill Johnson, said what he did yesterday. And that testimony has made news everywhere, Ben.
Yeah, he's just been on the job a couple of weeks, which he fell back on frequently in defending or at least not answering every question the lawmakers threw at him. We'll hear from him in a moment. I just want to kind of set the scene for you yesterday. So there was this hearing at the Assembly Energy and Utilities Committee, and incredibly, not every lawmaker who's on the committee was there. That kind of shocked me, because if I were a lawmaker and I were on a committee and having a chance to question the CEO of PG&E at this moment in time, I mean, heck, if I were the governor, I might try to get up there and question the CEO in public. Mm. But for the first hour or so after this news broke, none of the lawmakers asked the CEO about this. It was like there was this weird bubble hovering over that hearing room. And finally, I guess some staff members must have texted their bosses, because finally we got a question or two. And here is when it was finally posed directly to the CEO, Bill Johnson, by the committee chair, Chris Holden, a Democrat from Southern California. Here is what Mr. Johnson said.
So I have made the assumption when I got here that PG&E equipment caused the fire. Just made the assumption because that's the best place to start. The company had said in its filings recently it was probable that their equipment caused the fire. So this is it's a disappointment that this happened. Let's not do it again.
That sounds awkward, Ben.
Yeah,
it's just my very personal reaction.
It was an awkward hearing, but the what was even more awkward is that the committee chair actually gave the CEO the option to not answer, maybe because, you know, he felt it was just, you know, too soon. But I don't know. I mean, reporters would certainly not feel any qualms asking the CEO of PG&E for an answer in this situation.
Well, you think about a homeowner or a mayor or a contractor working in that area. I think if he was in front of a cross-section of people, anybody would step forward and ask the questions. So at least it was addressed in the hearing. I think if it hadn't been, can you imagine the way we'd be talking today?
Well, and sure. And to be fair, there were a lot of big issues being discussed about future solutions to this, because, you know, look, there's a lot of anger toward PG&E, and it was reflected by the lawmakers on the dais. And at the same time, everyone knows that simply raising your fist and shaking it at PG&E isn't going to do anything to prevent the next wildfire, and isn't going to do anything to come up with the money and the funding structure to support the victims of the next wildfire. Because, whether or not everything is PG&E's fault or not, which PG&E would contest to some extent, but not necessarily they're clearly saying we know our equipment had a role in this. It's not yet clear whether they will be able to pass the cost on to ratepayers or if shareholders will have to do it. But these fires are happening. They're getting more and more costly. And no matter what California does, and they are trying to do some forest projects to prevent some other big wildfires, they're also looking at, you know, liability funds that the state could have on hand, because these fires are still going to happen.
I am talking with Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief, Ben Adler. In this week's Capital Chat, we are talking about the announcement yesterday from CAL FIRE that PG&E's responsibility is confirmed in terms of the Camp Fire starting. To what degree that is still somewhat undefined. In the reporting yesterday, Ben, it came from lawyer Mike Danko, this interesting point that CAL FIRE normally releases its reports publicly if, he says, it finds that no laws were broken, but the fact that the full report wasn't released suggests, at least to him, that PG&E might have been negligent on safety issues. And he represents 2,000 victims of the fire. He says it indicates maybe a law was broken. You talked to Paradise Mayor Jody Jones yesterday, Ben.
And she wasn't surprised at this finding, but I think it still brought some small measure of, if not closure, a step toward that closure.
So let's listen to what she had to say.
It's a relief to have some finality and to finally know for sure. And I'm hopeful that this will spur PG&E to negotiate in good faith with the town regarding our lawsuit and their bankruptcy and all of that.
So, Ben, if you want to add more about what she said, please do. But I also then want to get to what happens now legislatively, because the governor had been involved in this along the way, working with lawmakers in terms of, I guess, trying to keep PG&E upright instead of the state totally taking over the utility.
I think there's still some lawmakers who would like nothing more than to see PG&E crumble, split up. Some folks want it to become public. On the other hand, I don't think any policymaker wants it to become the state. All of these debts, these, you know, potentially $30 billion in liabilities, nobody wants them to become the state's problem. So, Governor Newsom wants some measure passed by July, I think, because we'll be getting into fire season. We'll already be in fire season by then. And that's also when lawmakers go on summer recess for a month. So there are some possibilities under consideration. There is, of course, what Governor Jerry Brown sought last year and what the electric utilities sought, which is a change to California's existing wildfire liability law known as inverse condemnation, where utilities, if their equipment caused the fire, then they are liable for it, whether or not they were negligent in the maintenance of that equipment. Utilities say that's not fair and that's not common in other states, and they're seeking a change. That's opposed by, you know, in the insurance industry, trial lawyers, victims groups, virtually everyone else, and there's no appetite to do that at the state capitol. But the reality is, if the money's not there, the money's not there. Other discussions are centering over a liability fund, you know, a high-risk pool of sorts, and it's a very complicated subject. I can't explain it well. I think it'd be ripe for a separate discussion on Insight with someone who can explain it well. And then there's a question of whether there would need to be a bridge fund created to kind of bridge the gap between now and if there is that liability fund set up whenever it's able to really start working. There's one last point I'd like to make, and I've mm-hmm. referred to it a little bit, but just to expound on it a bit. Just because PG&E equipment started the fire does not mean, I mean, it means the company is liable, but it does not automatically mean that their shareholders will have to pay for it. If PG&E is found to have done its due diligence and been prudent in maintaining the equipment in question here, then they would be able to pass the cost, these billions of dollars of costs, on to ratepayers, you and me and all of our listeners right now. If, on the other hand, PG&E is found that they did not, it is found that PG&E did not maintain this equipment, that's in theory when shareholders would need to be on the hook for it. But this isn't going to be decided for a long time, and there is not enough publicly available evidence yet for us to know whether this is the case or not. So perhaps the people affected the most by this these fires are the victims. They don't have any closure, and the millions of California ratepayers, no closure for them from yesterday's report yet either.
And I mentioned that there are lawsuits from the victims of the fire. I also want to note that Paradise as a city sued PG&E in January, looking for damages for the loss of infrastructure, land, property, trees, public and natural resources, and included in that a loss of taxpayer resources. So they are layers and layers of litigation here. Meanwhile, Ben, what is the status of PG&E's request for a six-month extension? Because that reorganization plan was due by the end of this month. What's happened with that?
So they did ask for the six-month extension, and it's that request that got a reply from Governor Newsom yesterday, and he slammed it. He said, look, you know, you want to give him a little bit more time, okay, but giving him 6 months, there's no urgency there, and this is an urgent issue. And he said PG&E hasn't been doing what it needed to do to address safety and resiliency and customer service, and he did not mince words in his court filing yesterday, which— If you want to end on the coincidence that we began at, mm-hmm. What are the odds that this document would be filed in court, the same, and this report would be released on the same day that at the same moments PG&E CEO was testifying in the state legislature?
Right. Coincidence. All right, Ben. Thanks so much. That was a good Capital chat. There's a lot of information to get through, and we've posted a lot more online at capradio.org. Again, Ben Adler, thanks again.
Anytime.
And this is Insight. I do want to tell you that there are two stories from this week that we want to update. After yesterday's conversation about the arts budget debate in Sacramento, we received this statement from Tim Swanson in the city manager's office. He wrote, "Citizen input is critical to the budget process. The city of Sacramento encourages all residents to read the proposed budget and share their thoughts with city council members and staff. The city council currently is discussing the budget and is scheduled to vote on its adoption June 11th. So that will be a 5 p.m. Sacramento City Council meeting. Backing up to Tuesday and my conversation with Sacramento County Superintendent Dave Gordon about the budget crisis and potential receivership in the Sac City Unified School District, the update is that the latest interim budget will be presented tonight at a public board meeting. There were a few key points released yesterday. The district says just under $20 million, $19.67 million of district reserves will be needed to cover next year's expenditures, but the district has that money in reserve. Also, the more than $28 million in cuts and cost savings that have been adopted by the board so far this year have helped extend the date that a state takeover or receivership would be necessary. So the district says all of this amounts to buying some time to reach long-term cost savings through labor negotiations, and there has been a call from the state for all parties to get back to the table to negotiate. The Sac Unified Board meeting starts tonight at the Cerna Center at 6:30. There is a note here. The budget item isn't expected to be taken up until almost 8:30 tonight. So you can find more news about the meeting. You can also find a link to watch it live. That's at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight Live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. The Hoffer Award is a major literary prize named for the American social philosopher Eric Hoffer, but I'm going to say Eric Hofer, and you'll understand why in a moment. Mary Mackey, a longtime professor at Sacramento State, has just won the Hofer Small Press Award for her 2018 poetry collection titled The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. Mary has written 14 novels, including the New York Times bestseller A Grand Passion. She's written a number of screenplays, and this eighth and now award-winning poetry collection features new and selected poems from 1974 to 2018. Mary's back in the studio with us. Welcome, and wow, congratulations.
Thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
Tell me about winning this prize.
Well, it came as a complete surprise to me. I hadn't really known much about it, and I got a call from my editor saying, you just won the 2019 Eric Hoffer prize for the best book published by a small press. And I said, what? It was really wonderful and kind of exhilarating. And I was sort of blindsided by it. And I started looking up the award, and I'm very happy to have won it. It is a major award, but also it's an award for independent thinking and for small presses. And so many things that are involved with it make me feel very much like I'm happy to be associated with it and feel really honored to receive it.
Hmm. You were in New York at the time.
I think
a whirlwind part of your book tour.
Absolutely. I was doing 6 events in 10 days, and I was doing a special event that Harper's Magazine had sponsored for me, and just all sorts of things were going on. And suddenly, in the middle of the whirlwind, the timing was actually perfect in many ways. This happened right in the middle.
Tell me about the impact on winning any award, and of course this one in particular, but being surrounded by a number of literary people and being able to say, now this work has been noticed and recognized in a really special way.
It's really moving for a writer, I think. It's as if somebody has really seen your work and has understood it and understood it in a profound way and there's a kind of validation to it. You know, no matter how much and how long you write and how many things you've had some success with, you never really are sure exactly where you stand. And I think these awards are very, very important to writers. And then they're important to the people who now will be look at your book and look at your work and maybe perhaps find in it something that speaks to them.
Eric Hoffer, and it's spelled H-O-F-F-E-R.
It's
called the Hoffer Award.
The Hoffer Award. That's what everyone calls it, yes.
I'm going to say why Hofer might be a very interesting pronunciation to consider. He was a social philosopher born in New York, but he made his way out to San Francisco and then as a longshoreman started writing his thoughts down. So later in his life, did he become a profound writer of the thinking that maybe all along had been profound?
Mm-hmm.
But then he came into national consciousness and really had a lot of power in making people think.
Yes, he did. And I find that his trajectory is quite interesting. He goes from a rather poor working class family, doing odd jobs, even living on Skid Row, to becoming a professor at UC Berkeley. And I think his consciousness of the fact that talent lies at all social levels in this country is a really important observation on his part.
His first book, The True Believer, was published in 1951, and there was a lot surrounding his work in the 60s. I found an old clip of one of the prominent CBS news journalists, one of Ed Murrow's boys. They were called the Murrow's boys back then, Eric Severide, interviewing Eric Hoffer in an extended 5-part interview. And I want to play that clip. Listen closely. He's referencing a book called The Temper of Our Time that he wrote in 1967. And you're going to hear in him, in this clip, him say his own name, too. So let's listen.
When I finished this little book, The Temper of Our Time, I sent it to my new editor, a very fine person, a very bright person, but young, you know, and he mixed the up quality with quantity, and he sent me a letter. Mr. Hoffer, couldn't we thicken it a little bit? I mean, add something, make it a little bigger. I didn't get mad. I wrote my letter. Dear Mr. McRae, I said, the book has 6 chapters. Each chapter has at least 1 original idea. So you have 6 original ideas. Each chapter has at least 2 good sentences. Add it up. You have 6 original ideas, 12 good sentences. Now, when I find a book, even at 1,000 pages, 6 that has 6 original ideas, 12 good sentences, I celebrate for a month. And it's a fact. See, right now, as I'm getting older, how hard it is to find anything that will touch you. If I get just 1 little sentence in my book, I'll remember the book to the end of my life.
Well, now, how do your friends on the waterfront really look at you, knowing you write books?
Oh, every longshoreman knows that if he tried hard enough, he could write like Shakespeare.
If he tried hard enough,
anyone could write.
Any
like
longshoreman
this.
Could write like Shakespeare. All right, did you hear him say his name?
I did. He said Hofer. instead of Hoffer. Yeah, that's amazing. I did not know that.
I didn't either. But I think the power of hearing someone talk about their writing, and then you get a glimpse into how smart he is and how he thought. And in 2001, this prize was established and named for him.
Yes, it was. And you know, I think the enthusiasm he shows for reading and for ideas is also really a very interesting part of his intelligence in this.
There's a cash award that comes with the prize, isn't there?
Not for this particular. There's different awards in this category. There's an award for the best book published by a small press, by an academic press, and then there's a grand award, which must be the best book published by, you know, the angels. I'm not sure what. And that has a small stipend. It has a cash award to it, but the others don't have cash awards.
Well, I want to congratulate you again, because this was not just an award for a collection of poetry. All genres were considered.
Yes.
So your book was up against fiction, nonfiction, memoir, anything that you can consider in there. And Jaguars was chosen as the best.
Yes, and it was. And it was an international competition, too. So that was...
I'm talking with Sacramento poet Mary Mackey. Her latest collection, titled The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, just won the... All right, if you've said Hoffer, you could now say... The Hofer Award.
I'll try.
Did everybody catch that, by the way? Should we listen again just to the very beginning of that clip and listen for him saying his name?
When I finished this little book, the Temple of Our Time, I sent it to my new editor, a very fine person, a very bright person, but young, you know, and he mixed the quality with quantity, and he sent me a letter, Mr. Hofer, couldn't we thicken it a little bit? I mean, add something.
There it was.
Definitely Hofer.
Mr. Hofer, couldn't we thicken this a little bit? He mentioned everybody could write like Shakespeare. So let's talk about the part of your book that I think is very popular, your poems related to Shakespeare.
Yes. Well, this book covers my poetry from, there are 70 new poems and they're about, 48 new poems and 70 poems from my other collections. And they date back to 1974. And one of them was a collection from the early years of the Second Wave Women's Movement, which I never published separately, called Threatening Letters to Shakespeare, a threatening letter to Shakespeare. And at Shakespeare's women got to talk back. And I have Ophelia and Desdemona and Cleopatra and Lady Macbeth and Juliet. And these are just dialogues where Shakespeare, and, you know, I taught literature for years at Sac State. And these women just in Shakespeare's plays just get to say, you know, their side of the story. And so one of my most requested poems actually is a poem called Juliet.
And, would you read it, please?
I'd love to. Thank you. Juliet. I was a green girl, 14 and fresh, my breasts curled so tight in my chest that they ached. Time pulled through my body like sap, and I thought love grew everywhere like milkweed. Romeo was a human swagger. We drove over the state line near the end of spring and were married by a judge in striped pajamas who loaned us a cigar band for a ring. I said, look how the dogwood is in bloom, like the lips of small children in the naked woods. And Romeo said, let's stop for a cheeseburger. I said, when I see a river, I imagine a mouth at the end that could swallow us both. I said, this is the beginning of a great adventure. I said, I've escaped into love, and I'll never be unhappy again. But there was wax to take off the kitchen floor, and diapers to wash, and Romeo snored. And I found that love grows around the heart like the bark on a tree. And we had three children, and nobody died, and you can wait forever for the balcony scene.
That's Mary Mackey's poem, Juliet. And what's the discussion around that poem or your Shakespeare poem?
Well, you know, the Shakespeare poems, people love them because, the women in Shakespeare's plays have a very set feeling in our culture. Mm-hmm. And to sort of have the other side of it, of the consciousness of what the women might have been thinking, I think this putting yourself imaginatively in the consciousness of others is something that people can really understand and relate to with that. And also, this is a poem against, you know, I mean, there's some ways in which Romeo and Juliet is the story of two young teenagers who just, you know, they act in haste. I mean, if they just waited 5 minutes, you know, they would both be alive. And so this is kind of an anti-romance in that way. And at the same time, you see that there's love in the reality, but it's not the love of young romantic love. It's kind of long-term, but there's, you know, there's also some disappointments. And, you know, it's just... Are you looking at it?
I connect with a timelessness in it. It makes me think of my mother, my grandmother, my daughter, my granddaughter, the span of how what's written in here just reaches across time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Read another one, would you?
Okay.
Another Shakespeare?
Well, can I? I could read. How would you like a climate change love poem?
Oh, all right.
Because this is a very varied book. Some of it has these, early women movement poems. A lot of it has to do with my time I lived in the tropics for off and on for 6 years, and my look at, and then, the other 28 years I've been going to Brazil, and I'm very concerned about changes in the environment. And I really feel that in order to face what's coming down the tracks toward us, we need to preserve joy and love at the same time that we face catastrophe. And so this may be, as far as I know, the first climate change love poem. It's called In This Burning World. On the long road down the hill, the cobblestones tip us like drunken sailors under a sky smeared with volcanic dust. At the bottom lies a sea clear and pale as the skin beneath our arms. In this burning world, where we can never stop to rest, you reach out and brush the tips of my fingers. Our parched skin flakes off in tiny bits and floats up toward the sun, riding the great cone-shaped thermals of this slowly turning planet. We are two birds gliding through an empty sky, lost, uncertain, filled with unreasonable joy.
We have to feel and find and understand love if the planet's going to be saved.
I think so. I think, we have to band together. We have to preserve joy and human dignity and cooperation, and but also preserve joy in the face of change, because without it, we destroy what we're trying to preserve in ourselves.
Mary, what kind of field study were you doing in Brazil and Costa Rica?
I was actually getting a PhD in comparative literature, but I was acting as an unpaid research assistant in the tropics. And then my husband and I, later in life, my husband and I have been going to Brazil. He does work on environmental issues. So many things have drawn me to the tropics over many times. I had a mentor in... not really a mentor, a professor I worked for in college who was a great expert on the uses of tropical plants. His name was Richard Evans Schultes. And because of him, I became very, very interested in the tropics as a place to get away from everything human and civilized and see what the world was like. Most women in my time wrote about small domestic issues, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But I wanted to write more like, Melville. I wanted to board sailing ships and meet one-legged sea captains and, things like this. And so I've always tried to do adventure in my life in a way that was very kind of going out there and taking chances and looking at the natural world.
Jaguars appear in your work at different times, and there is that quality to the jaguar that is mysterious, but also sudden and unexpected. And maybe that connects somehow to your attraction for adventure.
Yeah, well, I think it's very symbolic in that way. Also, in the upper Amazon, when the indigenous people do their vision quests, they often transform into jaguars, which prowl the dream world. And my poetry has a strong mystical bent. A lot of it has roots in the work of not particular religions, but in kind of mystical visions. Some of which come out of the fact that I run very high fevers, and over 8 times in my life, I've run fevers nearly 107. And when this happens, I'm very sane otherwise, but when this happens, I tend to see sort of other kinds of things. And I'm making no suppositions about what these things are, but it's a different kind of world that makes me understand, I think, what mystics see in some ways. And that permeates my poetry. It's kind of a deep movement into sort of another realm. So you see the forest, but you also see the forest behind the forest. You see what else is there.
Some of your poetry is written based on those fevers in your childhood.
Yes.
When is the most recent episode you had?
The most recent episode was, maybe where I got that high, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, maybe a little longer.
You do talk about it as if it's like a drug-induced high.
Yeah, it's like a drug-induced high. And sometimes when I'm there, I speak in rhyme couplets for reasons nobody understands. I've talked to people about it. Mm-hmm. And I think, I've done it for 4 hours at a time.
Wow.
And I come out with poems. I often come out with poems when I have a fever. And I don't seek fever, but it has to be quite high to do that. Up to the point where you get over 105, you feel horrible. Once above that, you start feeling elated and you don't feel bad at all. You feel
Isn't
quite wonderful.
Isn't your life in danger at that point?
Yes, it is. Everybody else is running around saying she's going to die. We have to bring down the fever. And you're saying, never mind. It doesn't matter. You know, I feel fine. And let me tell you some more. You know, and then I'll say it in rhyme and I tell jokes and I'm just insufferable. You know.
When you're in it, do you have a sense of this kind of heaven or leaving the earth or any limbo
place?
I'm
not trying to, you know, I think I'm unusual in this that I don't specify a specific religion. I mean, most mystics have one. But I have a feeling of kind of moving into another realm where everything is warm and wonderful and pleasant. And I sometimes hear voices and see people. And, you know, obviously something amazing is happening. And I'm not sure what is happening. And I'm, you know, make no claims for it. But I do know that it has produced a lot of images for poetry. And it's given me a door to move back in there without fever from time to time.
Have you said to your husband, record me or family members?
Well, you know, people are too busy trying to keep me alive to record me. And the last time it really happened most severely was in a small town in Mexico where there was nobody, no doctor, no way out. Mm. And, you know, all he could do was rub me with alcohol and feed me aspirin and, you know, try to get me down. And it was very scary for him. Unfortunately, I wasn't scared, so I couldn't be as sympathetic as I should have been.
But you just made me realize that I'm taking for granted the fact that you're here. And of course, you've lived through every one of those episodes.
Yes, I have. Yeah,
that so, I'm thinking, can we capture it? What can we do with
it?
What
yeah,
happens?
Let's capture it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just have to say, if they ever give you a choice, the way to go, take fever, because really high fever. But I'm not suggesting people go out and get malaria. It's just, I think it's just given me a door into another way of looking at things that's been very important for my poetry.
And you remember a lot from being in that state,
I do,
obviously.
And that's the interesting thing about it. I do remember it. And my earliest memory of it takes place when I'm almost 3 years old, and I can remember it very distinctly.
So, sorry to spend so much time on these fevers, which are fascinating,
okay.
But what's the science that you've been able to learn about why your body does this?
Why my body doesn't deal with it. I think because when I was very young, and I don't remember this one, I had an extremely high fever where I would have died except my father was in a military hospital and had access to penicillin. And I think somehow the fact that that happened to me as an infant probably changed my physiology in some way. So that I seem to be able to tolerate them, but that I also tend to have I run high fevers. I'll run a fever of 102 at the drop of a hat. I mean, that happened to me last week.
I'm glad you made it back from New York. All right, before we let you go, what are you working on? What's coming next?
Well, I'm working on a series of poems about Cassandra because I think she's the poster girl for our time.
Mm.
She who said the truth who no one believed about the future. I don't see myself as a prophet. I'm looking at the, you know, this is part of my climate change interest. And then I have a series of novels about the goddess-worshipping cultures of old Europe, and I've got an outline for the final in the series of five novels.
It is always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you. And again, many congratulations on the Hoffer, now Hofer Award.
Thank you so much for congratulating me on the Hofer Award.
There we go. All right. We'll post a link to our previous conversation. You can hear more, including Mary's reading of the title poem in the book. And again, she is the winner for Best Book Published by a Small Press. Thanks, Mary. And you're listening to Insight on CAP Radio.
Locked in a darkened room.
This is Insight Live on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. That is the music and the voice of Sarah McKenzie. She was born in Australia, a scholarship student at the Berklee College of Music, now based in London. She's a singer, songwriter, and that was her on piano, too. She has upcoming stops in China, Spain, France, and on June 23rd, she will perform at the San Francisco Jazz Center. So Sarah was at CAP Radio recently. She talked with jazz music director Gary Vercelli about her new album, Secrets of My Heart. We're featuring her music and that conversation in this week's Sound Advice. And she begins their talk by describing her meeting with the legendary composer, arranger, and jazz pianist, Michel Legrand.
Actually, my bassist, Pierre Bourseguet, he worked with him regularly for over a decade. So there's a connection there. But Michel actually came to my Paris apartment. He came to check me out, I suppose. And I was very nervous about this moment because I had read interviews about Michel Legrand when he was young and when Miles Davis came to check him out. And apparently Miles would stand at the door and if you're any good, he'd come in. And if you weren't, he'd just walk straight on by. So I was a little worried that Michel was going to apply the same treatment to me. But he came in and I played several of his compositions for him. And then when we played Watch What Happens, he jumped on the piano and played with me. It was one of the great highlights of my life, you know, to meet one of the real master composers of our time.
And you've done one of his tunes on your forthcoming album.
Yes.
Your new album, which is...
A beautiful composition called You Must Believe in Spring.
When lonely feelings cloud the meadows of your mind, just think, if winter comes, can spring be far behind? Deepest snows, the secret of a rose is merely that it knows you must believe in spring.
Sarah McKenzie was born in Melbourne, Australia?
Yes.
And tell me about growing up and how you first became aware of jazz. I'm betting it wasn't through your peer group.
No, it was not. Look, I had classical music lessons as a young kid, and I really wasn't enjoying those. So my dad found me a blues and boogie-woogie piano teacher at the age of 9. And this made such an impression on me. I love the feeling of the blues. It was just so much fun to play piano. My piano teacher, he said, you know what, you've got a good feel for the blues, you should check out jazz. And I said, what's jazz? And he said, well, go down and find a record at the record store and tell me what you think. So I bought a compilation, and the first song on the album was Oscar Peterson's Night Train. And I fell in love with the piano playing and the music. And from there, I checked out all of the piano trios, Ray Brown and Gene Harris, Monty Alexander, Benny Green. I love them all very much.
It's all about groove. It's all about feel. It's all about trying to find something real. People tell me that I'm crazy. Well, maybe I'd rather be crazy than just lazy. I'd sail a ship across the sky if I could tell you why it's all about truth and not about gain. It's all about chasing down that final train. People tell me life ain't easy.
Your schoolmates, when you told them about Ray Brown and Oscar Peterson, you probably could have been mentioning baseball players as far as they were concerned. They didn't know.
I mean, I think everyone thought I was very weird. They're all listening to pop music, you know, Sarah, come and do a Backstreet Boys dance routine with us. You know, this was the common response. I sort of liked that I had my own secret world, you know, and I put on my jazz records and listen and compose my songs and... I had a great time.
Sarah, I've read that family is very important to you, and I have also seen that your travel schedule is quite international and quite aggressive, I might say. You do travel a lot. Shanghai, you're going to be playing there.
Yes.
And back to San Francisco. How do you balance being away from family and the excitement of travel?
For all of my life, I think I would have to say I only wanted to be a musician, you know, and I wanted to study and learn and be a world-class musician and travel the world, you know, and that's and play and share my music with people. That's always been my dream. So I'm so happy to say that I have the great privilege of being able to do that. Of course, though, because I'm Australian, Australia's just a little bit far away. I don't think you can really base yourself there and do what you do. So I try and get back as often as I can because I am a family person and I love my family very much. But they're very supportive of what I do and they can't wait to see concerts when they come overseas as well. I try my very best to get the two happening together.
Well, where do you call home now?
At the moment, home is London.
Tell me, when you first went to the Berklee College of Music, you went on a full scholarship, mm-hmm. as I read. Were you intimidated at all? Did you feel like you fit right in?
Totally. No. In the beginning, even though I had a full scholarship, so for a while there, I was very excited and felt elated that I had, you know, won this incredible opportunity and they see something in me, you know, that gives you a lot of confidence. But when I got there, everyone is so brilliant, you know, and not everyone is on a scholarship. So it does humble you a lot. And definitely my first semester, I was in a piano transcription class with a bunch of incredible jazz pianists who just had it all over me in terms of facility and technique. And I just thought, oh my God, I'm just not as good as them. You know, like it's a mistake. They made a mistake. So there was a little bit of extreme self-doubt to begin with. Second semester, I sort of changed my attitude. I sort of said, okay, if you keep going this way, you're going to quit and you're going to drive yourself mad. So focus on what it is that you do well. Okay, so Sarah McKenzie, you write your songs, you know, and people like them and you like them and you sing and you play. Put together your quartet and see if you can get some concerts. And the moment I started doing that was the moment the Berklee doors opened right up for me. My quartet was asked to play a composition of mine, That's It, I Quit, on their Berklee video station there. And after that, I was asked to play with the Boston Pops Orchestra. Yeah. And then I was asked to take a student group to the Monterey Jazz Festival. And then I was asked to play with Ingrid Jensen at Dizzy's, you know, and it reaffirmed to me that, look, you know, you don't necessarily need all of the chops and facility in the world and to be able to do cartwheels with your instrument. You know, you need to be able to connect to people and you need to be real about what it is that you do and what you can offer people. I think I definitely learned that lesson there at Berklee College of Music.
Now, you've mentioned Paris, your time spent there. Also, it seems you've spent some time in Brazil and that's had an impact on you.
Oh, I loved my time in Brazil. It's come from loving the Brazilian music for a long time. I love Jobim. I mean, the album Stoneflower is incredible. I love Elis Regina. So going to Rio was such an exciting moment for me, particularly because I had the opportunity to play with some of the original members from the Antonio Carlos Jobim band. And this was such a highlight for me to be surrounded by these legends of Brazilian music that I said to them all the time, thank you so much for playing with me. You know, thank you. And they said, Sara, Sara, de nada. You know, we're very happy to play with you too, de nada. It was a beautiful moment for me and it made an impression and I had to write about it.
When you come along, why don't you come and play a song, de nada. You're welcome just to be to come along and sing with me, de nada. Try to keep the beat, da 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 da, and repeat, de nada. De nada is the melody, the simple little symphony for life. When you hit the ceiling, you get buzzing over feeling. De nada. De nada is the music of the night. De nada is the rhythm, is the light. De nada is the melody, the simple little symphony for life.
We're talking with Sarah McKenzie, and Sarah, you've done a song that's associated with Dinah Washington.
Yes.
On your new album, which is pretty bluesy.
Yeah, I love Dinah Washington. This was a really fun song, I have to tell you, because we were in the studio in New York and we just recorded 6 or 7 tracks and we got to the end of the evening. We're all pretty tired, I'd say.
I'm so blue.
And then I started playing this blues, Come On Home, just a little bit impromptu, if you would. And the bassist, Pierre Bouseguet, he started coming in halfway through the song. and the drummer, Donald Edwards, he started coming around on the second time. And then Dan took the best guitar solo I've ever heard. And by the end of the song, we were just really excited. Did you record that? Did you get it? Was it on tape? And they said, yes, we were rolling tape, and we were happy. We listened to it back, and, you know, look, it's a blues, so in some ways I guess it's simple, but it was magic, you know, it was like a connection moment.
Won't you please, please, please come on home to me? Won't you stop hesitating? Don't keep me waiting. Please, please come on home to me.
Sarah, I'd like to ask you about your compositional process. Mm-hmm. Does traveling inspire writing, or does the music come first? Do the lyrics come first?
There's a lot of magic that goes involved in songwriting. Sometimes you don't know where songs come from at all. Travel definitely inspires songwriting because you have new experiences and everything is different. In terms of the actual technique of it, I usually like to start with a title that I feel gives the context for what I was feeling at that time. You know, you need a great title. It needs to say something. You know, the secrets of my heart. Ooh, you know, what's that? It's not like, you know, my car is red, you know. Mm-hmm. It's something that implies there could be something more, like we could be lovers.
Just like the secrets of my heart.
I write the melody first, and I need a strong melody because I realized early on when I was writing that if I wrote lyrics and melody at the same time, that it gets a bit lost, the melody. So you need to make sure you write clear melodies. Once you've got that, you can start adding the lyrics, but the lyrics must work with the melody. So everything has to have a meaning. Everything has to be connected. For me, that's the art of it.
I sense that you're kind of a romantic at heart, too.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I do love life, and I love to see it through my rose-colored glasses, I guess. You know, being in Paris was such a... I was so excited, and, you know, walking by the Seine and having a glass of Bordeaux in a little jazz cafe and thinking about what Hemingway did when he was here and Stefan Grappelli, and, you know, my imagination can sometimes go a little bit wild.
You've got to follow the secrets. Follow the secrets.
Sarah McKenzie is at the San Francisco Jazz Center on June 23rd. We'll post a link with more information. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us.